that be a lesson to you. When I meet you, you may not ever be able to get rid of me. My name is Carla Rowell, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm just really delighted to be here. Thank you, Lee, for having me out and getting to share in this remarkable weekend. Since the beginning, this event has had a life of its own, and it is spirit-filled. And I can hardly look out at all my current friends and friends I haven't met yet and just, you know, continue to be broken open to see you. And I'm not a big crier all the time. It's not that I'm against it. It just doesn't. But it bubbles up inside. You know, I just, you guys get me. And I'm so glad to be here. And thank you to all of the committee and the board and everybody who has anything to do with putting this thing together. Registration. I know Ann and Becky were over there and a bunch of people just, you know, I know what kind of work that takes, and it's sometimes unseen by the masses. You know, we scoot by and we get our badges and say thanks, and maybe, you know. So thank you for all of this, and I hope that it continues for a long, long time. My husband sends his love. Some of you guys know him, Doug, and he sends his love, and he likes you to know he's 3 months longer sober than me, and. Whenever we have an argument, he says, "Oh, honey, just wait 3 months." Okay. We have a happy, happy home. We didn't get together till we were 21 years sober, and I was 51 years old, and he was 63. So hang in there. I'm so glad you guys didn't tell me I had to have a boyfriend to get sober, or, you know, any particular criteria was involved in that I just needed to have some kind of desire to quit drinking. They even took the word honest out of that. They just said, come on. But I get to do a 10-step at home, you know, once in a while. But it's, you know, it's so nice to be older and hard of hearing because, you know, because when you're together a while, we've been married 8 years and together 10. And you know, sometimes when you're a little bit off, you start to look at the person the way they breathe, you know, something like that. But I have some kitchen behaviors that I don't like, you know, or that I, you know, sometimes get caught on to watch him do or don't do. And then he'll leave. And he's so innocent the way he walks around, like not even knowing, you know, the disaster he's causing. So once in a while, I'll come into the kitchen. I'll see that he's again offended, you know, that way. And like probably left a wrapper on the counter, something that ruins my life any given time. And if I'm spiritually fit, I'll get to see it, you know, and go, okay, just pick it up and throw it away, you know. But when I'm not, I'm like, son of a bitch. And he can't hear you go, what, honey? I get a second chance. I get to say, do you want a sandwich? Would you like a sandwich? I love second chances. I love them. And if I stay awake, I get to notice them, you know. Sometimes I get a little bit of grace right there in the moment. He's the first face I want to see in the morning, the last face I want to see at night. And I've heard some of the others talk about their husbands and their loss. And I know that it could come, you know, passing into the next realm is a fact of life. You know, we're here for a very short time. And thank God that I get to experience this. And you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is not the only miracle that exists. But for people like you and me, it's the miracle we needed. It's the miracle I needed. I've experienced awakenings in spirit since I was a small child. Sharon talked about it. Tammy talked about it. They've all talked about it in some way. You know, I've experienced spirit, but I could never establish and maintain a relationship with this spirit. I knew it existed, and I couldn't keep my hands on it. I couldn't continue to experience it. And when alcohol came along, it intervened in my life in a way that nothing else could. It felt like spirit. It felt like a sufficient substitute. It felt I could pray, worry about what's God's will, where's my turn, what am I supposed to do, la, 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 or I could take a drink and I'm good now. And I let it. Alcohol became my spirituality. It was my growing up muscle. It was the thing that made me feel buffered from you and the thing that made me feel connected to you all at the same time. Why wouldn't that be my higher power? For people like us, that it works for. 90% of the others of the population of the world do not experience what we experience when we drink. And that doesn't mean they don't get drunk. A non-alcoholic can tie one on, but they don't get up in the morning and want to go do it again, you know? And somewhere along the line, we all get to that point of torturous alcoholism where we are either drinking or thinking about drinking, no matter where we come from. I've got this allergy of the body that happens when I'm drinking and this obsession of the mind to drink alcohol that happens when I'm not. And somehow I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. You taught me to treat the spirit and I get better. And that's how I've experienced it. I know that we argue a lot about a twofold disease or threefold disease. And I just, you know, I've experienced it as a twofold illness with a spiritual remedy. That's how it fits in me. That's how I digest it. It doesn't really matter. It's sort of like that recovering thing. You know, I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I have. But I am not cured of alcoholism, which is why we're here at step 10. Because we've just finished reading about the ninth step promises and all that happens. The awakening happens after the ninth step, if we do that in order, or a particular awakening. We've cleaned up the past. We've made some amends. We've started to trust the process, which I wasn't sure of when I got here. When I got here, I knew how sick I was. I knew where I had been. But I didn't know if this is exactly what I was going to need. You were all a little too social for my taste. You know, I didn't know if I was going to be able to pull that off. If I could have come in here and stolen what you had and taken it home with me, I would have. And I'm one like many of the women that you heard over the weekend. You know, I left home at an early age. There was a lot of physical violence, and I have seen both sides. I've been both sides. I've been bullied and physically abused and sexually abused, and I have physically abused and been a bully myself. Because what happens when I get scared? I come at you. I was tired of being scared. And I left home at an early age, and alcohol just soothed that. I roll up my sleeves and I take over the management of my life. I am good. My favorite place to be back then was on my way to somewhere else. And I'd get out on the on-ramp of the freeway and I'd just go. And I felt better already. I didn't even have to be there already. I was on my way. It felt like the bottle in the glove compartment for me. Like I didn't even have to have that thing open to already feel better. Consequently, because I was so young, I started ending up in some of the Southern California hotspots like Indio Jail and Riverside Juvenile Hall and L.A. Central. We did that whole dance. And when I was 14 years old, I landed in a place called North Beach in the San Francisco area, party town. One guy dropped me and my friend off, and, you know, we were just on our way. We were wide-eyed 14-year-old kids. We're standing on the corner there, and I look to my left, and there's Carol Doda and her flashing boobs in neon. She was a famous stripper, and to my right were hookers and dealers and pimps. Oh, my. And we weren't on that street for 10 minutes before a couple of guys approached us, offered us money for sex, and we said yes and did the next indicated thing, and boom, a whole new career path opened up for us. And I started living a day at a time in a way I've not had to live in a very, very long time. Even before I got sober, I was able to move out of that. But Dr. Silkworth talks about our alcoholic lives after a time become the only normal one, seem the only normal one. And I didn't know it at the time, and I couldn't have told you this in these words, but I had already begun to trade away every God-given talent or gift or potential that I had for the effect that alcohol produced. And like it was said over and over and over here, alcohol told me what to do, and I listened because it gave me so much. Alcohol for me created and preserved so many illusions until it threw me away, and I had to find a power bigger than it. Because even though it was destroying me, I was still going for that 10 minutes of time, that 10 minutes of relief, that little window. And I know some of us come in here having built and lost great empires. You come in here a little bit later than life, but you still know what alcoholism is. Some people never outdrink their wealth. They will never outdrink the physical, material circumstances of their life, but they will sit dying in their mansions of alcoholism, because that's what we're talking about here. We're not talking about circumstance. And it was so funny how before I got sober, before I got here, how much I thought my life was built on circumstance. And you guys, I come in here and you guys teach me that it's not the circumstances of my life. It's the attitude. It's my attitude. You taught me that if I will do this, that there is no circumstance that can happen that can cause me to drink. And I want to just talk about this for a minute. You know, we talk about all the sad things that can happen. Why would you drink? What caused you to start drinking? All that, you know, and we get new and if my mother died or if my father died, or, you know, we think of the worst that could happen. Maybe that would make me drink, right? And then we stay here a little while longer. We come to trust the process, and then we realize all that stuff can happen. We don't want it to happen, but all of that stuff can happen, and I still don't have to have a drink. But I want to say this, and that is, I hear people say, it's not about the alcohol. Now, I know what they mean most of the time. They mean, hey, getting sober is not just about quitting drinking. We have to quit drinking to get sober, but then we also got to get spiritually fit in order to quit drinking. So that's kind of a pain in the ass, you know, it just goes in circles. But I never want to forget, especially that first half of the first step. I'm allergic to alcohol, and there will never be a time, no matter how spiritually fit I get, that I'm going to be able to take a drink of alcohol in any form at all. Not sacramental wine on Sunday morning, because it's religious, you know. And again, here too, I want to say this. I don't think you have to choose between being religious and spiritual. Religions were built by spiritual people. Now, they can go awry, and we know it. So can AA. So can we see people in AA. I've made mistakes along the way in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's us individuals. It's the trees in the forest. So we forgive and hopefully grow and admit our mistakes. But I'm not against religion. When I first got here, I liked that little joke about, oh, I'm a recovering Southern Baptist, you know, ho, 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 because it sounded so funny, you know. Sounded cute. But I've come to realize that everything, every idea that has been presented to me in my life has brought me to the next. And I've needed all of it. So I'm an and lady now these days. And that. This works. And that. And that works. And that. I can go anywhere I want to and worship and sit. And you know what I hear in most spiritual traditions? Because I am a voracious studier. You know, I can't always get to school. So I don't like the word self-taught. I don't think that's appropriate but I just devour this. I want to see. And you know what they all say? Love and service. Love and service. Love and service. Love and service. Get out of self. Die to self. Look within. The kingdom of God is within. Within, within. I was thinking, I had written this down because I was going to be so astute last night. And then you get, you know, you hit the 8-minute buzzer and you're like, okay, go. 8 minutes of 60 years of living. Let's go. But I was thinking about this. If God is everything or God is nothing, there's no line between the sacred and the ordinary. If God is everything, everything that's happening And my friend John says, God is not causation, he's comfort. And we talked about that last night. All the voices bringing us to the same thing. And I was reading this thing the other day, and it said, it's by an old Sufi poet. He said, for the raindrop, joy is entering the river. For the raindrop, joy is entering the river. To be one of many. I think Beth was talking about that. You know, to be one of many. Well, that doesn't sound that good for somebody who wanted to be a movie star, right? Go out to Hollywood Boulevard, and they're not auditioning out there, okay? So don't go heading out there anytime soon. No producers strolling Hollywood Boulevard looking for you. Not for that, anyway. They don't want to put you in their picture. Not that picture, anyway. Not some unfortunate pictures. And then just these, to get them out of the way, because they've been on my mind. And I was reading, I was just scrolling Facebook, you know, that thing that we all have a love-hate relationship with. And this little meme from Galileo Galilei came up saying, I do not feel obliged to believe that the same God who has endowed us with sense, reason, and intellect has intended us to forego their use. Like, God gave us brains to use. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some technical stuff. You know, this thought brings us to step 10, and that right after the ninth step promises. It's on page 84. I hear about people reading, you know, 86 through 88, 86 through 88. Wait a minute, what happened to 84? 84 and 85 tells us what the stakes are. That's where I was going with that. You know, I know eventually if I follow the trail, it'll come back. And I'm getting older, too, so it's a whole lot more fun. Annoying for you, maybe, but me, I'm all right with it now. I got sober when I was 29 years old, and I never made really much of myself. I lost my daughter. I walked away from her on a bar stool. I went and sat on a bar stool when she was almost 4 years old. And just like I had done every day before work, and I had my same drinks, my same afternoon drinks on my way to work. I didn't hate the job I was going to. I didn't love my daughter any less on that day. But I drank those drinks that afternoon, and I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop this time. I couldn't stop this time, and I drank those drinks, and I sat on the bar stool, and I lost the job, and I lost the kid sitting there on the bar stool because I couldn't get up. I got up yesterday. I got up the day before. I got up the day before that. And I went to work, and then I went home. And somewhere along the line. So I lost the kid for about 4 years. And I married a man thinking maybe if I put my life back together like I thought you needed me to, then we'd all be okay, get the kid back, you know. Now, I got her back when she was 8 and a half, and I didn't get sober till she was almost 10. Because the circumstances of my life don't heal me. And I came to trust the process, and I got in here and I took the steps, and you know, I you know, by a lot of things we call coincidence or synchronicity or any one of those things, my next door neighbor happened to be sober, and she came over and delivered the message to me, and I was 29 years old, and I didn't get sober the day she delivered the message. It was about a week and a half later, and I sobered up at home. I shook it out at home because there was just nowhere else for me to go. People have been trying to help me all my life, put me in places, and sitting in front of a judge in juvenile hall waiting for placement. You know, and they tried mental hospitals where they give me all the drugs, and then they tried a program that was built on Synanon when Synanon was working way back then, you know, where there are no drugs or anything. They tried it all. And my dad used to say, I think they're just trying to buy you some time, Carla. And maybe he's right. I come from a family where my baby sister committed suicide at the age of 17. She wasn't a drunk or a drug addict. She was done. It wasn't a cry for help. She was done. My baby brother died of drug addiction and alcoholism when he was 30 years old. My mother died of end-stage liver disease just about almost 10 years ago. And my last remaining sibling lives in Wisconsin, and when she's not drinking, she's on the Vicodin maintenance diet. So I really feel like my dad might have been right. Like maybe we bought enough time to keep me alive and okay till I got to you. And, you know, other families, they may have the same dynamic and they don't have any alcoholics in there. I don't know, but I just, that's how I make sense of what happened there. I feel, now I feel fortunate for every step I had to take to get here. And that's what's at stake if I don't continue. Amy said it, continue, practice, and improve. To continue to work with this process, to continue to incorporate these principles in my life. And AA is not the only thing I need. Some people, let me, read your own big book. Read your own big book. Read your own big book. Read it with us. Read it alone. Read it. So that when somebody says, like, I can do it too. You know, get up and misquote the big book. Sounds good. AA will solve all your problems. That's what I heard. What our book says is spiritual principles will solve all our problems. And this is where we've outlined. This is the map. So, this thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory, continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. Sometimes past mistakes will crawl up in there too in the 10th step. Don't worry about doing a perfect fourth step, because in the 10th step, if you stay awake, you'll catch it. It'll come in. It'll come up. And I do, when I do a written 10th step, I do it just in the same way I do a 4th step, because I want to find a map to my own responsibility in whatever situation I'm talking about, whether it's the past in the 4th step or currently in the 10th. But I use the same kind of thing. Where had I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Which now, to me, all these years later, it's I was selfish because I was afraid. I was self-seeking because I was afraid. I'm dishonest because I'm afraid. And Bill talks about that in the third step stuff, in the pre-third step stuff. You know, all the gyrations I go through to try to run the world. Because I'm afraid, driven. I'm driven by fear instead of led by spirit. I can't even feel spirit because I'm going 60 miles an hour with self at the lead. My favorite tagline, I still use it. I still, you know, cross out the we words and put I, a little exercise, cross out the we words and put I, and then the past tense words to current words. So instead of saying we were, I say I am. And if I read that out loud to myself, first person, present tense, the first requirement is that my life run on self-will is hardly a success. And then later on, I begin to think life doesn't treat me right. As soon as I hear that, because I'm like in the middle, I begin to think life doesn't treat me right. Because I'm like, what? What'd I do? Why you? What? Step on the toes of my fellows. Excuse me. What? So, we want to continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. I got aware of it in the pre-third step stuff, then took a little inventory. Step 6 and 7 came alive. I love the essays, you know, and I just tend to think Bill woke up more to the process of 6 and 7, how much they really meant. There were 2 paragraphs in the big book and 13 pages in the 12 and 12, talking about. And we're never, you know, we're going to work toward perfection. But Father Dowling said, you know, any person willing enough to practice this step repeatedly. So that tells me I'm going to have to do it more than once. Repeatedly. But I'm going to try. And I want to say this too. We might never get step 11, but that the gap between my efforts, and I believe it's an effort, it's a focus. I have to make some effort. You know, I had to do some things I didn't want to do. I didn't feel like being in AA till I was about 9 months sober. I didn't feel like not drinking till I was about 9 months sober. The obsession to drink alcohol for me was not lifted till about then, in the middle of making my amends to my family. That's when finally I realized it had been a few days since that horrible noise inside my head telling me I needed a drink. And I always thought I had to drink to shut it up. But I don't. But I had to learn that and be uncomfortable. I had to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. So I come to trust the process, and realize that fear, it always boils down to, for me, to fear of two things: fear of losing, fear of not getting. And all these years later, it's very subtle. All these years later, it's like fear of not getting your approval. Oh, one more time. God dang it. One more time. Really? You know, but it doesn't last as long. If I can start to recognize this, I can do a preemptive 10-step. You know, when I feel that adrenaline starting to churn up, my solar plexus starts to boo, bing, you know, and I'm getting ready to say something that needs to be said. My favorite form of a preemptive 10-step was, I learned from a lady named Susan when I was brand new, and she said, breathe through your nose, honey. Just breathe through your nose. Breathe through your nose, honey. It's okay. And then what I realized all these years later is that when she said that, she meant because it keeps your mouth shut. We vigorously commenced this way of living as we cleaned up the past. Through the ninth step, we've cleaned up a good chunk of the past. Now, if you're anything like me, it took, some of that stuff came up as I was ready to see it. You know, especially with my family, my pride was so big in the way, but you. You know, I learned to keep my mouth shut. But the tenth step is so beautiful for me, the experience I've had with this, because By my 20s, by the time I was 20 years sober, I had learned how to behave. I know how to behave. I know how to move through, maneuver, and look like somebody who's sober. I know how to do that. But that didn't always stop me from walking out the door going, God, I hate them. You know, and being left with the residual of, you know, acting better than I feel starts it off. Absolutely. There's a story in the back of the book that we all use about praying for somebody for 2 weeks when we have a resentment, you know, and that puts us in the right heart. It puts us in a posture of willingness. But unless I bring it back around to my responsibility in this thing, where had I been resentful? Where had I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, or frightened? Where had I been? What did I do to cause it, or in retaliation? You know, what am I so afraid of? Looking bad, which is usually what it is now. Oh, it's not even something really honorable, you know. It's the way I look, or what they think, or, you know, how did I do? But you know what's at stake for not doing that? A drink. It says here, what did Christy read? It's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action. Rest on our laurels, because I'm having a good day. It's good. Good. We're headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. There's step one. If I'm doing step 10, I'm doing 1 through 9 all over again all the time. All the time. Alcohol is a subtle foe. And one of my favorite stories in the front of the book is Fred the accountant. You know, I love that guy because he was not having a bad day. He was having a great weekend, wasn't he? He was successful in his business. And he walked through the doorway and said, I think a cocktail sounds good. So if I call it a cocktail, it sounds friendlier, right? And he had just begun to feel the nip of the ringer. So I can't drink even on a good day. I need to remember that. The doctor's opinion on page XXX, you know, this allergy of the body we have, let's not forget it. This is what differentiates us and sets us apart as a different entity, not a different species. Emotional by itself does not make me an alcoholic. Jealousy doesn't make me an alcoholic. But if I'm an alcoholic and I stay jealous, eventually I'm going to need to go for the sufficient substitute because this spiritual thing is not working. Because I'm not letting it. I'm not making contact. Alcohol is a subtle foe, and it can sound like, it's just a little white lie. I'm not going to put everything on my tax return. He won't know. And God, you know, one of my favorite things you guys have taught me, it still works when I do it. I'm not going to say I do it perfectly, but when I'm alone and I do the right thing, when I know and I act in a principled fashion and nobody's looking, that's character's built in the dark. You know, where nobody's looking. What, you know, and it's been said over and over. There's nothing in AA you're going to hear that hadn't been said 5,000 years. But Father Tom Weston says something that I really love. He says, you've got to be pretty sick and tired to find us interesting. There has to have been something that brought you through this door. Our purpose, our single primary purpose here. A lot of places that celebrate spirit and spiritual principles and spiritual values and celebration of God in one form or another. A lot of places out there. And you're going to hear about spirituality in general. You're going to hear how people treat their spirit in a very general way. But what we do in here in Alcoholics Anonymous is we take spiritual principles and we aim them right at alcoholism. Because the stakes for us, if we remain in that restless, irritable, and discontent condition, whether you believe you had it before you got sober, or, I mean, before you started drinking or after or whatever, if we keep it, if we stay in that, or if we don't treat that, we will end up drinking. And right back in the very spiral that we started in. This is our purpose. This doesn't happen to everybody. You know, I couldn't go to my boss who didn't, you know, he was a non-alcoholic. I don't call them normies. I call them non-alcoholics. That's just what they are. The very important thing that separates us. Because everything else I can relate to. But he could hold a grudge. Oh, my God. I was amazed, you know, at how somebody could just, one thing, and you could feel him burn. You could feel the engine go on. You know, people who don't have alcoholism might have a bad day or even turn out a little bit more bitter and twisted at the end of their lives than they might have had they gone ahead and gotten through it or grown through it. But me as an alcoholic, I may never get to see what I could have become if I am interrupted, if I interrupt this process of practicing or continuing practicing and improving. So those are the stakes why I continue to take this personal inventory. However you do it, there's a nightly review that a lot of people like to use as an inventory on the next page. It's part of step 11. But when I really need to get to the bottom of my responsibility in a situation, I write out a 10-step just like I would a 4-step inventory. Because there are some places in there, especially the third column, I've come to really love where it shows me what I believe. And my beliefs are not always true. But somewhere along the line, for whatever reason, I adopted them. Maybe I needed them. Maybe it was just an illusion anyway, like so many other things. But for whatever reason, it's not working now. I don't even need to spend a lot of time on why. Why did I do that for so long? Oh, let's not go there. We don't have time. It's just, you know, even those ideas I got from my family, you know, all I I almost couldn't wait to do my fourth step with my sponsor because I was sure she was going to go, well, no wonder. She did not do that. I realized when I got sober, I was 29 years old, and those people had been long out of my life, and I was still drinking, and I was still mad. There's a way through this. There's a way through this. So after the ninth step, we just get up and we do it again. My friend Joshua says, lather, rinse, repeat. Just do it all again. Oh, and I was starting to say this too, and I want to say it. I hope you hear it. What the gap between my efforts and perfection is God's grace. And some days you may see me and you may think, I think she's just given about 55%. It may feel like 150 to me. Looks to you like 55. You know, I get a little bit nervous when I see people saying, well, she doesn't walk like she talks. Because at any given time, I could look like that. I don't know what that is. And I had to stop doing it to other people, too. Because I don't know what they're going through. I want to give them a second chance. See if they want a sandwich. So, oh God. So I got to tell you this story because I started it last night and it's important because it came alive in a way to me in my sobriety that in a big way when I was 5 years sober and I told you I was raped by an intruder, came into my apartment and he was there a few hours. He tied me up with a phone cord and he had a big knife and it was, you know, it was not good. And after we got into a little tussle, I ran for the front door and my own bolt lock kept me in so I couldn't get out. And then we had a little wrestling match. And instead of getting madder, he dropped the knife and he went out the same window he came in. And so I did not kick his ass. I wish I would have. But Bill Cleveland came away one time after he heard me talk. He said, yeah, she kicked his ass. I was like, oh, I wanted to take that for a minute, but I didn't. He just left and he dropped the knife And it turned out that I knew this guy. I'd actually watched him get sober 30 days before I did. And I watched him get his life, his wife, his kids and everything back. And then he joined the church and left AA behind. And see, I want you to hear this too. Anything I do in pursuit of improving my conscious contact with the power greater than myself, this power I call God, or the power that is, anything I do is in addition to Alcoholics Anonymous, not instead of. But he went out and he lost touch and forgot who he was. He forgot what he was. And this is what happened. You know, he just got madder and madder and his wife died and things happened and he thought it was circumstance and he ended up there. So we had a court trial that followed. And as part of the defense, they had a lot of the guys I'd known years before get up and testify. So I had to get a character witness for me. And, you know, I just told you a little bit of my story. And when I, you know, there was a time where you could not use the words Carla and good character in the same sentence. And by this time I was working at a big fancy investment firm downtown Los Angeles. It was a place I never would have walked in the front doors of years before, would have had no business being there. And people like Henry Kissinger were walking the halls and I was walking undetected because I was doing what they asked me to do. So the department head volunteered to come and testify on my behalf. And they told him all about who I used to be. He said, well, she shows up early and she stays late. And she was where she said she was. And see, that's Alcoholics Anonymous just speaking for itself. That's how he had experienced me. And then it was my turn to testify. And I got up in the witness stand and I looked out at him and I saw him. I saw him sitting at the defense table, a place where I've sat before and I could sit again. And up till then, I'd been using the seven-step prayer as kind of a mantra, just a touchstone, just come bring me back to the breath. I was so afraid and I'd been jumpy and pissed, you know, and anger still at 5 years of sobriety was my default, my favorite way to respond to you because it made me feel protected and like I had a momentum and like, you know, that aggression felt like power. I think Amy said that too. Aggression felt like power. But I knew it had to go. It had to go. It's like a suit that doesn't fit anymore. I can't be angry. I can't not be angry on my own. So the seven-step prayer became a mantra. And now I'm sitting in the witness stand and I look out and I see him. And here again, here's a prayer that came to mind at the top of page 67. Though we didn't like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. He, like me. If I were to take a drink, I could be sitting in his very seat. And what happened to me in that minute was we became two alcoholics sitting on opposite sides of the courtroom. That's all we were. We had to level the playing field. This prayer levels the playing field and brings me back to compassion. I am never going to forgive from a spiritual hilltop. I'm never going to forgive because I'm better than you. I got to see the vulnerability in me to be standing where you are. It brings us back to a level playing field. And even in that was a particularly intense time. But even in my, as the days pass and as I use it today, it causes me to realize that I have been, could be, or am being just about anybody I've ever resented at any given time. And it brings the compassion up to the surface. It allows me to put my hands on it, to use it, to let it work through me. And not perfectly, but allows me a minute. You know, and that combined with meditation, prayer and meditation, when used together, prayer and meditation provide an unshakable foundation for life. These things, 1 through 9, learn it. 10 and 11, grow it. 12, share it. And then we circle back around. Here's a good thing from Facebook, you know. Steps go in a circular motion. Somebody else's 12th step was your first step. Somebody's first step was somebody else's 12th step. Yeah. One for Facebook. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, "This is a sick man like me. This is a sick..." I thought he was laughing at me. I was going to, "Yeah, ho." No. So I was staying on my own side of the street. And then when we saw our faults, we listed them. And you know, this brought up a whole old belief system about, you know, I was talking to the old timers and I'd get tired and I'd say things like, "Well, maybe a girl like me is bound to have something like that happen even in sobriety," when I still had a God that I didn't realize I still had a God that kind of shot things at you to see how you'd do with them, you know. "Maybe he thinks I can handle it." And they said, "Man, you just got in the way of someone else not looking to do God's will. Just got in the way, just like people got in your way when you weren't looking to do God's will." Right? You know, it's so easy. God, one more point to one more flag to plant to be able to be self-righteous, right? We just can't wait sometimes, you know. I get into the big book finally, and then I'm like, "Oh no, you got to do it this way." It's like, oh, it's so easy to do. So coming back to bottom of page 85, step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. We shouldn't be shy on this matter of prayer. Better men than we are using it constantly. And I just want to say, because I'm going to run out of time pretty soon, but that if we used only this outline between the middle of page 84 all the way to the end of the chapter, page 88, if we followed those directions, not just read it, sponsees call, "Oh, I read it." And here's the thing. I thought I made up this analogy. I know now I did not. But it's like reading a cake mix box. You can read it. You can understand it. You can conceptualize it and realize that you may have, you could possibly one day make the cake that's on, that there's a picture of on the front of the box. But until you open the box and start handling the ingredients and doing what it says, you're not going to have a cake. And that's going to be the same thing with the difference between reading pages 84 through 88 and doing what it says. Because it'll keep you busy doing this stuff. This tells us what we can do when we retire at night, on awakening, and all throughout the day. It gives us something to do, something to see, something to ask. prayer, consider, act, pause, pray for your nose. And the 11-step prayer is not the prayer of St. Francis, although it's a great contemplative meditation. Prayer, the 11-step prayer is simply asking, help me see your will for me and grant me the power to carry it out. It's that simple. My friend Howard P., who just passed, God rest his soul, and thank you for all he, for how he let God spend him, you know. He was spent when he went. And he used to say, wherever you see God pass, mark that spot and go sit in that window again. I've had many, many windows. And my meditation in the very beginning when I first got sober was sitting down. I'd take like a book like Reflection, Daily Reflections. We didn't have Daily Reflections even back then, but I had like Each Day a New Beginning and the 24-hour book and One Day at a Time, which is, you know, sorry, it's not conference approved, but it works. But what I want to say about that is we need to know what is AA, what is in our little basket. It doesn't mean we're separate from or that we're the only ones who know, but we need to know what this is so we can use it properly, so we can participate and preserve what was here for us when we got sober. So I am all for that. But it doesn't mean, you know, red means stop. That's not in the big book, but it's a good idea, you know. So a lot of good ideas. And later in the book, Bill says, you know, make use of what religious people offer. Make, you know, be quick to see where they're right. But for me, in addition to, not instead of, Alcoholics Anonymous, I needed the miracle put just in this way. A lot of spiritual awakenings before I got here. When I got here, I needed one. And when I couldn't, when it didn't happen spontaneously, I needed the map. And this is the map. So I started out, I get up, I was smoking 2 packs of cigarettes at the time. And 3 packs a day, actually. Just so you know. That's so important. But I'd get up in the morning and I'd sit and I'd read and I'd sit for 5 minutes or something, have a little meditation and a cigarette then afterward, and then get up and go about my day. And then touch base with God all throughout the day and stuff. And I needed to often, especially in the beginning. That obsession, like I said, wasn't gone. I called my sponsor so much. I'd leave a meeting and go home and call her. And instead of getting mad at me, she was like, you're going to get this thing, aren't you? You know, she didn't say, God damn it, didn't I just see you? But as I grew, it was right before I was 2 years sober, and I had to stop smoking. I couldn't breathe anymore, so I wanted to breathe. And so I used the steps. I used the same process. I'm powerless over this. God, I need help. And then a guy from our home group came and brought me he gave me a 6-month complimentary pass to a gym. He said, this helped me, you know, why don't you try it? And I realized not only did that help me get healthy bodily, you know, but it also, you know, nature's antidepressant, you know, this is not a talk on medication. I'm just saying that we, you know, there's a lot, this is not a treatment for alcoholism, but it is an enhancement for my life. It's taking care of the vehicle now that I am sober. And so I went to the gym and I started realizing that there was a meditative point to this and a meditative method, you know, just the repetitive nature of everything we were doing, and I got quiet, and when I would drive home, I would just burst into tears. You know, it was a physical thing, it was a spiritual thing, it was, you know, it was a window that God gave me. And you know, I tried a lot of things, you know, as I went. That kind of went by the wayside, and I got work, I think the next thing was rollerblading. I started rollerblading, you know, and that's very, very zen, you know. I'd go out by the beach. I'd go out by the beach after work, and I would just You know, down me and the dolphins, you know, watching them. Here comes the curb. You don't argue with the curb. The curb exists. You lift your foot. Moving. And then that kind of went by the wayside. And about 17 years sober, I was getting a little bit, I don't know if this has ever happened here to you in Atlanta, but where I started to take myself a little bit too seriously, you know, some stuff had happened and I started building that wall and rolling up my sleeves and taking over the management of my life, thinking, well, God, maybe this is my call. And that perfectionism doesn't mean you're necessarily perfect. It just means that you're now obsessed with the idea of being so, which I was a compliance officer for an investment firm, which, you know, I was very good at on my job, because my job was literally to wake up in the morning and try to figure out all the things that could go wrong and then go out and see if I could prevent them, which, you know, and I was good at it. But it made me a terrible friend, you know. I got pain in the butt to be, good Lord, my sponsees are like, I don't want to call her, you call her. I love her, but I don't want to talk to her. You know, I didn't know. I believe in the power of this God, because so many times it's answered questions I didn't ask out loud. Sometimes I didn't even know the questions needed asking, you know. Like, so my next thing was I found my way into a ballroom dance studio, believe it or not. I walked in there, take a free rumba lesson. Now, you cannot be stiff and brittle and do the rumba. You just can't. It's impossible. And I get through this free rumba lesson about halfway, and the teacher stops and he says, oh, God, Carla, do not try to dance like a good girl. I don't think they will believe you anyway. What happened? I danced for 5 or 6 years, I think, and had a great time and opened up and realized, you know, I was allowing people a closer proximity to me. I didn't even realize I had shut that down out of fear. You know, I didn't even realize it was just automatic and it needed doing. And maybe it wasn't going to happen intellectually. It had to happen some other way. It came in through another window. And what I found out when I was dancing was that if I will just surrender and allow myself to be led and stand in frame and do my part, which is very little, just my part, not the results, and I allow myself to be led, I never know, and I'm not worried about the step I'm about to take, and I'm not upset about the step I just took. If I just stay in frame and allow myself to be led, I never know what pattern I'm executing till we're done. But I know what's happened in the meantime is I've gotten to experience that presence of the power that is, that God in this moment, this right now, right here, right now. This is where it is. In addition to, not instead of, my friend Don Newcomb, who Sharon talked about, his wife at one time had been her sponsor, and Don was a good friend of mine. He always said that he never would have had to do time if I had been his driver. I like being a favorite. I don't care why. I don't. But he said, I didn't know about that dancing thing at first. He said, I was afraid it would take you away from AA. You loved it so much. It lit you up. And I was afraid it might take you out the door. And he said, but I know now. He said, I see you now. And he said, I see what had to happen was that little girl who went to North Beach had to step aside so the lady who dances could come out. You know, and our book promises that our dark past become our greatest possessions. You know, and my past has been woven into a huge tapestry that's my life. And it's there for those who need to see it. They can see it. Yet I walk a free woman in the real world, awake and alive. And because I stay awake, I can take advantage of new opportunities. And because I stay awake, there's a moment between the thing I feel like needs to be said and the thing that I actually say that might be more compassionate or more true or more helpful. Fireworks don't always go off when I'm sitting in meditation in the morning. Fireworks don't always go off, but throughout the day I have a better day and I give a better day. I do a much better 10 when I've done 11. I do a much better 11 when I've done 10. And I'm much more able to do that 12th step, you know, to go out into the world. And we are not meant to huddle up in here and hide. Alcoholics Anonymous put me on the game board so that I can go out and become the person, be the person that the expression of the power that is that I was meant to be. And each of us gets that if we want it. It's my great privilege and responsibility to do this work. My privilege and my responsibility, and each of us get one. Our founders did not write this book and say, hey, if you'll do this, maybe one day you'll be able to call somebody and they'll tell you they had a sister who had a brother whose father had a spiritual awakening. They didn't say that. They said, if you do this, if you do what we did, you'll get what we got. And everywhere has been my monastery. Everywhere. I've always thought that I needed to be in a cave. I needed to go live in, you know, find India or some, you know, ashram somewhere. And I still want to do that. I still want to visit and go see if I can help somewhere, somehow. Those dreams. But they've taken a perspective. And then when I'm not there, what I started to realize is wherever I am is my monastery. Chuck C. used to say, what I came looking for, I came looking with. It's inside. Every spiritual tradition I've ever read says the kingdom of God is within. Look deep down. Bill says deep down inside every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God. In the last analysis, after the resentment, after the worship of other things, after the pomp is set aside and the clouds part for just a minute, I get to experience this power that is. And the more I've done it, the more I want it. And I get to experience this joy of living, and I'm just going to close with this story because I just love this story. Sorry, I'd have to indulge me. And I hope you have a good time. I got to experience the joy of living one more time when this little pit bull lab named Sammy walked into our lives. Now, I know we have dog people in the room, right? We got dog people. Oh, my God. This Sammy came waving her little butt into our lives, and we travel a lot, so we wanted to take care of her, but we weren't sure. So we tried to foster her for a while. We got her all fixed up and stuff. And I'd get up in the morning, I'd go to feed her, you know, and she is just, whoo! You know, I set the food down in front of her, and it's the same food she saw yesterday and the day before and the day before that. Same food. She's a new day. She's like, woo! We are going to eat. And then she runs into the bedroom where Doug and I are, and it's the same faces she saw yesterday and the day before and the day before that. Same faces, new day. She's like, oh, it's you. And we are going to party. And so she comes in and she plays with us for a little while, and then I see her go jetting out the doggy door, you know, out into the backyard. The same yard she was in yesterday and the day before and the day before that. Same squirrel, same cat, same possum, same raccoons. Same thing, running in circles, you know, goldfish mentality. Woo, a castle! Woo, a castle! Woo, a castle! And I look out the back window and I see her, and I know that. I know what that's like. I don't have it all the time, but I know what it's like. And that's what I shoot for. I don't want anything getting in the way of that. Because it's not stupid joy. It's not like I have to deny that anything's going on that I'm having to put some effort into. It's not like that. But it's that joy that really all is well. All is taking place just exactly as it should. And I want to be ready to do my part. Boy, when I wake up in the morning on awakening and my feet hit the floor and I say thank you, and then I go and I sit in meditation for 20 to 30 minutes, and then I read for about 45 afterwards. I'm a spiritual text person. You know, I do a deep dive into different studies at different times, you know, over the years and stuff. And when I do that, man, I wake up, I get to feel that, what Sammy's showing. I get to feel what Sammy looks like. Well, when I don't, and I'm in a particular hurry on any given morning, and I wake up and I blow past the thank you, you know, and I start talking to the people who aren't in the room, when I go make the coffee, you know who those people are, right? You know. And I go hit the coffee. Before I know it, I am sitting on the computer, in front of the computer, looking for a fight on Facebook. talking to people I don't know about things I care nothing about in the long run. But they've all become very, very important right now. Every day is the day I must take the vision of God's will. I know we got new people in here. Stay, get comfortable with being uncomfortable for a while. Sit with us. That's what the fellowship is for. And I love, I can't remember who said it exactly, but I liked it. It was like, the steps will take you into the fellowship, and the fellowship will take you right back into the steps. So, but we've got some particular neuroses that are quite charming sometimes. Come in and let us love you till you can love somebody else. Thanks for letting me share.